It was our summer study where we looked at Galatians, Ephesians, and Philippians.
Yeah.
And at least with Galatians and Ephesians, you know, Paul's early conversations to those churches after founding them in his missionary journeys and writing back to them was about the disgruntledness within them and their fighting with each other about, you know, Jews and Gentiles and those sorts of things and who was in and who was out. And amazingly, as we were studying that, you know, many in the Bible study, there were about 30 of us all together in the two sessions we do, 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. on Wednesdays. But many of them said, we haven't changed much.
Good morning. My name is Dennis Shaw, and I want to welcome you to Mindful Leader. This is a podcast on church leadership, and this is episode 7. I plan on putting this episode out on the internet on my my podcast server about August the 6th or 7th. It is registered with iTunes. I personally use Overcast to find it, but you can also find it through the iPhone podcast service. Or if you can't find it and register it and get it where it's on a regular basis, don't hesitate to send me a note at Dennis, D-E-N-N-I-S, at Mantuan, M-A-N-T-U-A-N, .org. And I'll have that email address in the show notes as well. Our guest this morning is Wybra Price. I met Wybra in 2009 at the Wesley Theological Seminary Doctor of Ministry program. Wybra is a graduate of Centenary University there in Shreveport, where he is actually located now. He's a member of the Louisiana Conference. He's an elder in the Louisiana Conference. And like my wife, he is also a graduate of Southern Methodist University. He has a master's in divinity from Perkins School of Theology. And he graduated there, and he's been appointed in the Louisiana Conference for many, many years, since 1992 or 1993 or so. He has experience as a district superintendent. And when I met Wybra, he was still coming out of his experience with Hurricane Katrina at Slidell United Methodist Church in Slidell, Louisiana. My sister, as I mentioned in the last podcast, may have been a delayed casualty from that. She was in Biloxi, and she passed away in January of 2006. But Wybra was the pastor at Slidell during that hurricane. Welcome, Wybra. Good to see you. God bless you. Thank you for having said yes to being on here.
Good morning. It's a blessing to be with you, and it's a blessing to reconnect from our doctorate of ministry days.
It is. Wybra was one of the bright ones in the class. I sat near the back of the class, so I wouldn't get asked a lot of questions. Wybra was up at the front, and he was regularly polled. When I asked Wybra to talk a little bit, I thought we would start the conversation with the topic of disaffiliation. Of those of you that listened to my last conversation with Zach Bechtold, number 6, Zach is the pastor at Bozeman, Montana, and we talked a little bit about disaffiliation in Mountain Sky. I thought I would, in asking Wybra is talk a little bit about disaffiliation in other places. And he has had some experience with disaffiliation at Louisiana Conference. Let me ask you a very open-ended question on that, Wybra. What has gone on so far with disaffiliation in Louisiana Conference?
Well, unfortunately, like lots of our congregations across our connection, there are folks on all ends of that spectrum related to an understanding of 2553 and even an appreciation or lack of appreciation for our LGBTQIA plus folks and the way in which that unfortunately has lived out. As you know, in 2019 at General Conference, paragraph 2553 was approved, allowing what was my understanding, the intention — I was not a delegate to that general conference.
Nor was I.
The intention was to allow churches who opposed the current language of the discipline, which has been language that has been present since 1972 for the most part with very little changes. But the current language of the discipline, if they oppose that current language, to exit the denomination if they so chose. Obviously, with the delay of annual conference, general conference due to COVID multiple times, I think when the delay occurred the last time, postponement to 2024, at least here in Louisiana, there were a group of folks, a group of churches who said, we're tired of waiting. And though I was still on the cabinet at the time, I was in my fifth year of a six-year term as a district superintendent in Louisiana Annual Conference, there were a group of folks who said, we don't want to wait anymore. And they were primarily churches that were in support of the current language of the discipline. There is, I don't typically like to use the words traditional or progressive, or because anytime you use a label, those labels are limiting.
They are.
And when we limit ourselves, I think they never fully capture someone's understanding or appreciation. But one of the things that happened was even in Louisiana, there was a conversation about 2553 and how 2553 would be enacted. I was one of the voices who felt and still feel that we misinterpret 2553. As I'm not an attorney, I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. So don't have that background. As I interpret paragraph 2553, it says, for reasons of conscience in opposition to the Book of Discipline and or for the actions or inactions of the annual conference and or bishop. At least in Louisiana, to my knowledge, there were really no actions or inactions that qualified. And the churches that have since disaffiliated in Louisiana, and if I have the number correct, it's about 168 currently of the nearly 450 churches that we have in our annual conference or had in our annual conference. Those 168, all of them, in my opinion, did not have a reason of conscience in opposition to the current language of the Book of Discipline. Needless to say, the Judicial Council had a ruling, if I remember correctly, it was on the case, one of the cases coming out of the North Georgia Annual Conference that said you did not have to state a reason of conscience. And thus, unfortunately, in my opinion, unfortunately, several annual conferences and others began to say, well, 2553 can be used for those to exit the denomination, even if you don't have a reason of conscience in opposition. I sit here today still firmly believing that we misinterpret 2553, we've allowed, unfortunately, in my opinion, churches to exit the denomination under that. But at least here in Louisiana, there, in my opinion, these churches did not have a reason of conscience in opposition to the Book of Discipline. All the churches that have chosen to leave the denomination have been churches that support the current language of the discipline has been in existence since 1972. Yeah. They do not support same-sex unions. They do not support the allowance of those unions in the United Methodist property, nor the ordination of openly practicing homosexual clergy. Those languages that are the current languages of the discipline as we sit here still support where their position is, but yet they have chosen and been allowed to leave our denomination.
Like you, I was a little surprised at the flip that occurred in the 2019 General Conference. The words that were passed that became paragraph 2553 was oriented around those who were dissatisfied with the current language. But what has happened over the last 5 years, 4 years on this is that the actual sponsors of 2553, which were offering an opportunity for churches in disagreement with the current Book of Discipline to leave, have instead taken their own option that they offer to other people. They have taken the option themselves and exited. And it's partly out of impatience, as you went to. There's at least there's several conferences that have said what you said, that there is no issues of conscience. We are enforcing the current discipline. So you have to leave under some other provision. And so they've actually allowed some people to leave under different circumstances than that. Going back though to the departures, one of the issues that I have witnessed across the denomination, across the connection, has been the fact that the General Conference imposed a standard of what would be done, which was the unfinanced liability for clergy retirement. And if you had health insurance, you could add that in there if you wanted to, and apportionment for 2 years. And then conferences have added little add-ons for that. Were there any add-ons within the Louisiana Conference, or was yours pretty straight exactly out of 2553?
No, we did have add-ons here in Louisiana through working through the Conference Board of Trustees, which 2553 authorizes to add additional criteria. So in Louisiana, our criteria was current year apportionments plus two. So plus 2 years, so an additional year of apportionments.
Okay.
Unfunded pension liabilities were part of that as 2553. And our proposal was also, what was adopted by the annual conference was the repayment of any funds, loans, grants within the last 10 years that any congregation may have been given. The initial proposal, I was the cabinet liaison to the trustees when this debate was happening. The initial proposal that went to our annual conference, which would have been 2021, was an equity stake in property. But that was taken out and removed in our virtual annual conference that we had in 2021, obviously due to COVID. So that equity stake for property was removed. But so what happened was we ended up with an agreed annual conference approval of trustees' proposal that allowed for a current year plus 2 years of apportionments, unfunded pension liabilities, and repayment of any grants or loans within the last 10 years.
Ours was, we went with two in Mountain Sky, and we had a very similar 10-year grant history thing in Mountain Sky, almost exactly the same thing. If you've gotten a grant in the last 10 years, then you were asked to pay that back. So did you have a lot of, in Mountain Sky, we were put on the Wesleyan Covenant Association list of conferences that had a very high bar. Part of that is that we reserved the right on churches that had a very close vote to ask for a portion of the equity in the building. I don't think, as a matter of fact, we ever got to that. I don't think anybody was ever asked to contribute that, but it did annoy people, the fact that they would have a vote but not know what the bill exactly was until after the vote was over. But it was to try to fund a little bit the remnant that might be left. And of course, the larger the remnant, the more money it would need. So that bothered people. But we made the list. Mountain Sky made the list for being hard to get along with on the disaffiliation process. Did Louisiana make that list as well, or do you know?
Yes, Louisiana did make that list. And ours primarily, as I understand, was because we had added the additional year of apportionment, current plus two.
Yeah.
And many saw that as onerous. We also were being led by the then president of the Council of Bishops. Because of her leadership, there were folks, you know, who felt like we were being onerous in how we exacted or asked folks or didn't allow folks to leave with the minimum criteria, even though 2553 allowed the Conference Board of Trustees to enact additional standards.
Yeah, it's. I think on, frankly, on some of this, everybody was in a borderline no-win situation. It was no matter what you did, there was going to be somebody was going to be unhappy with that. But what I want to focus on, if we could, for the rest of a little bit of the rest of our time together, is not so much necessarily on those that left, but on those that remained, and the healing process. Now, I realize you have been not a district superintendent for 1 year. I understand that, but and so I'm asking you sort of how would you handle? But the issue seems to be, first thing is that no church is 100% stay or 100% go. So if a church had had a high number of people that wanted to stay, there was still some people who might want to go who have indeed maybe left since the vote has occurred. There's churches in probably various levels of turbulence that are on that. What would be your wisdom to particularly the lay leadership of a local church as they try to put themselves back together again in 2024 based upon what's happened in 2023 with disaffiliation and or departures?
Well, first, let me begin by saying I probably left the cabinet table at the right time. I had finished up my sixth year out of the eight that would be allotted to me by discipline to serve consecutively. But I recognized and I saw in the last 2 years of my time as a district superintendent, this trend happening. And even to this day, I still speak to some of my colleagues on the cabinet around the cabinet table here in Louisiana and recognize that if I would have stayed, my spirit would be very, very different. I was a part of the first nine disaffiliations that we voted on in Louisiana in 2022 at our annual conference session in 2022, five of those nine, I was their district superintendent. Part of that has to do with the cultural nature of North Louisiana as opposed to South Louisiana. More of our disaffiliations congregations have been in the northern part of our state. But I recognize that hurtful nature of that. The other piece I recognize is that congregations that went to votes, even if the votes did not meet the two-thirds threshold, had great schism. You mentioned, there was obviously folks on either side of that. Anytime you vote, you have winners and you have losers. And that became very evident. And I think lots of our churches who went to congregational votes, and we've obviously here in Louisiana, of the 168 churches that met the threshold, the two-thirds threshold to disaffiliate and have been approved by the annual conference, there are at least probably another couple dozen who voted that did not meet that threshold. And some of them were very, very close votes. Many of them were very close votes. Particularly in some of our smaller congregations and mid-sized congregations, where those votes, were only within 10 votes of not meeting the threshold, and it creates a large schism. I have a good friend and colleague who just moved this year, who was a part of a congregation where a vote here in our community, a vote was taken. The vote did not meet the two-thirds threshold. But a majority of the people who voted wanted to disaffiliate it, wanted to leave the United Methodist denomination. So you have a congregation where a majority wishes not to be United Methodist any longer, but yet did not meet the supermajority of the two-thirds threshold to require the disaffiliation. Those churches, it's an uphill battle for lay leadership and clergy leadership to say, how do we mend that? How do we bring that back to the center of what purpose we serve? I can't answer that other than vicariously through some of my colleagues and others. I can tell you what we did here at Broadmoor United Methodist Church in Shreveport, in the sense that we recognized, because we had a large church in our community, as well as other churches surrounding us, who were moving toward votes, and we saw the contentious nature of that. We saw how bitter that had become. We saw how hurtful that had become. In this particular situation, there were threats, lawsuit threats, bodily injury threats, others that were happening. And the leadership here at Broadmoor said, you know, we really want to study this and look at, do we really need to go to a congregation-wide vote? There were certainly people who wanted to do that. Matter of fact, I had a conversation with a gentleman yesterday who's still discerning whether he's going to remain here at Broadmoor. And one of the reasons was he did not get to vote, in his opinion, as a congregation. We did not do a congregation-wide vote. We did an internal discernment process where here at Broadmoor, we met with all of our small groups, every Sunday school class, adult and youth Sunday school class, every choir or music group. We met with each of those groups in settings. We talked about in those settings, what does the current language of the discipline say? Broadmoor lives into that current language of discipline. Whether I agree or disagree, as an elder personally in the United Methodist Church, I vow to uphold the discipline in its current language. So I have been faithful to that. And I did that as part of my onboarding statement with them when I came, because this was obviously waiting in the wings for me when I got here.
Absolutely.
So we did what we call these listening and learning sessions. We had 15 of those listening and learning sessions where we had over 208 people participate. Now, we worship about 250, a little less than 250 at the time. We were worshiping at our first quarter average attendance here at Broadmoor in Shreveport was 248. We felt like we had 208 people of the average 248 people in our first quarter of this year who participated in these listen and learning sessions. At the end of those sessions, we conducted what we called a survey, and we were very intentional in saying, this is a survey, not a vote. Please repeat after me. This is a survey, not a vote. And we asked them to complete a survey, and we used the some of you may be familiar with Adam Hamilton's piece about conformists, nonconformists. We kind of redid that.
Yeah.
We asked them to, you know, choose one of four options, you know, where they would say, I can support the LGBTQ ordination of marriage, but I cannot stay in a church that does not, or I support the LGBTQ ordination in marriage, and I can stay in a church that that disagrees with that, as well as I oppose the ordination and the marriage, and I can stay, or I oppose and I cannot stay.
Yeah.
So of those four options, you know, each was asked to complete that little survey, we came out of that as a leadership with 76% of our folks who said, if the discipline changes or the discipline doesn't change, I can stay United Methodist.
Okay.
So of the 208 folks, 76% of them said, I can remain United Methodist if it stays, changes or doesn't change. And that to me and my pastor colleagues, as well as to the leadership here at Broadmoor United Methodist Church, was a telltale sign to say, we do not need to move toward a congregational vote. It's too destructive, too hurtful, too painful. And thus, in March of this year, we made that statement clear to our congregation that we were not moving toward a formal discernment and a congregation-wide vote. Thus, there were folks who immediately left, and some are still leaving, but yet there are some folks who have come from sister churches, sister denominations even.
That going back to what you were saying there, I mean, it would be great sometimes if people could tattoo where they were on the front of their forehead. It would so you had some appreciation when they start talking to you what's in their mind. What I was going to ask, I have two parts I was going to focus on. They're very different. One was to the ones that you suspect are ones that cannot stay United Methodist, but have not left yet, have not left yet, and you suspect they are. Are you approaching ministry towards them in a different fashion, or are you encouraging your associates to be ministry towards them in a different fashion, or are you just letting the issue sort of just lay dormant unless they come to you and talk to you?
Well, we have here at Broadmoor, fortunately, one of the things we do, we track average attendance, worship attendance, and it's folks to sign in either virtually or register their attendance in worship. And we meet weekly as a staff in a gathering that we call Lost Sheep. Maybe that's might not be the great term, but and if someone has missed 3 weeks or more in worship and they have been here, obviously we've had to redefine our lost sheep in a post-COVID time because we've had folks who've not come back post-COVID, and unfortunately, like lots of our congregations, I think across the denomination, across the United States, our attendance. Where it was over 400 pre-COVID, and again as I shared, is nearly 250 or so now. So we've been working through that. But one of the things that when someone's name shows up on the lost sheep, we contact them either by appointment, by phone call, by email, whatever it might be. And actually, that was my conversation with the gentleman yesterday. He was on our lost sheep. He had been in worship. Post-COVID, had been in worship in my year here many times. He and I had a conversation in my office about his disgruntledness that he didn't get to vote in a congregation-wide vote. I explained to him the process. All of this is actually on our website. There's a tab on our website, broadmoorumc.org, called UMC Status, where or UM Status, I think it's called. Where you can look at our results and what we did here at Broadmoor. But this gentleman, again, was on that list. I called him yesterday and said, "Hey, I've not seen you in a while. I've missed your presence." And he in a good phone conversation. Partly was he lives in a retirement community here in our community. And I was I'm going there for another meeting today, and I was going to stop by and see him. And I said, "Would it be helpful for me to come and visit with you?" And he says, "I just don't know if it's helpful or not." He says, "I've not made my decision yet, but I'm leaning toward leaving." And but I've tried to remain in contact, tried to remain connected as best as possible, as much as they would allow me to. I said, actually in my Bible study last night, I teach a pastor's Bible study on Wednesdays. And I said in the Bible study, we were looking at Philippians. We just finished the book of Philippians last evening. And as hard as those conversations are, as difficult as they are, I hurt more for those who I have no knowledge about.
Yeah.
Those who have walked away with no connection, those who've walked away with no contact. We have had here, I mean, we had a prominent family leave Broadmoor. They did not go to the former sister United Methodist Church that disaffiliated, the large one here in town, which several have. They went to another denomination. And when I inquired with them about their leaving, though they did not want to share a lot, their real statement was, "We wanted to go to a congregational church and no longer be a part of a connectional church." Although they went to another sister denomination, Christian denomination that supports LGBTQIA plus on a national level, because it's a congregational church, the local congregation, the local leadership of that denomination is allowed to make their decisions, and they wanted to be a part of that. Basically, they didn't want to be a part of fighting and arguing anymore.
It's created challenges. It's just created. How do you have a staff and bills ministry set up for, let's say hypothetically, 500 in membership, 250 in attendance, and now all of a sudden you're 250 in membership, 125 in attendance, and it changes the whole dynamic.
Yeah, we certainly have that here at Broadmoor. I mean, I have a list of families who have, that I know have left, others that I speculate, and it may be, you know, somewhere in the tune of 20%. I know, working with my business manager, I know we, for instance, some of them have been very gracious and said, I'm leaving, but I'll fulfill my pledge this year, but I won't be pledging in the future.
Yeah.
But because of a few key deaths that we've had this year, and because of those who have left and who will either not fulfill their pledge this year and or will obviously not be making a pledge contribution the year, I know I'm entering into 2024 already with $135,000 deficit in the sense of income, expected income in 2023 that I know I won't have in 2024.
Wow.
And that's what I know about.
And that's what, about 25% of your 25%?
I'm a little over $1 million in the budget. But it's about 20% of my congregation, I think. But the other side of that is we are blessed that we, because again, we had a large church in our community that did choose to disaffiliate. There are several families who have been worshiping from there.
Yeah.
And a couple have joined. I've said to my leadership, this is a cause for concern, not a cause for panic at this point. We are blessed that we have some budgeted reserves from previous years that we have been holding in escrow, that it's going to take probably 18 to 24 months financially for us to figure out who we have and who we don't have. But we're going to actually have to make some budgetary concerns and unfortunately, I assume it's this way in Mountain Sky and other places as well. The only areas of ministry where I really have the flexibility to make budget adjustments are in the areas of staffing and personnel and the areas of program.
Yep.
Obviously, there are lots of other fixed costs, utilities, which I have no control over, other than trying to be as energy efficient as possible. But there are lots of other fixed costs. So I can only cut personnel and or programming. And we all know that when you begin to, from a leadership standpoint, when you begin to cut personnel and or programming, then you're in some ways you're cutting your nose off in spite of your face.
Yeah.
Because if you want to grow any, it's going to take those ministries, leadership, staffing leadership, as well as lay leadership, as well as programming dollars to grow the church into a potential future.
Yeah, the church I served in Utah about 5 years before I got there, 6 years before I got there, had some leadership related issues that led to a downturn in giving, which led to a downturn in staffing. So it becomes its own self-perpetuating phenomenon. One of the things I think we wrestle with in Mountain Sky, and I suspect as I worship here in the Baltimore Washington Conference where I live now, is that I'm not sure people always necessarily understand what the value of the conference is. They live in a world that they perceive that what happens at the conference and at the general church has no impact on them. And I think I don't know how it is in Louisiana, but I think in Mountain Sky, we haven't done a particularly good job of communicating the value, particularly in the development of clergy, what role the conference plays in that. So I'm asking you this question. I didn't set you up with this one in advance. I was going to go there, but how do you deal with communicating the value of the Louisiana Conference to the average church in the Louisiana Conference? Was there a program, or is it sort of it happens because it happens?
Well, I concur with what you're observing in Mountain Sky, and maybe even Baltimore, Washington. But as one who has been a part of the institution, when you sit around that cabinet table as a district superintendent, you are institutionalized, whether you think you are or not. And
right.
Obviously, there are those who, you're an extension of the bishop and the ministry of the annual conference, and there are certainly areas where I think we've done a decent job, but certainly areas where we've not done a good job of helping to see the value of the institution. We also live in a culture, and I don't know if that's Louisiana, just Louisiana culture. My sense is, as I look at our national culture and politic as well, we live in an individualistic culture in the sense that we don't value the institution as we have valued the institution previously in various ways. So we devalue the role of the conference. I do agree with you. I think the role of recruitment and or training of clergy and resourcing clergy and congregations is a value, a great value. And one of the things we ask here in Louisiana is, what is the role of the annual conference, and what is it? What is the only, what are the only things the annual conference can do? And obviously, in our current polity, ordination, training of clergy, ordaining clergy, equipping clergy is a primary role of the annual conference.
Yeah.
So we do that we communicate that in various different ways. Sometimes somewhat effectively, obviously other times not as effectively, but I think it's a sign of the culture in which we live. I mean, we have become so individualistic in the sense of, as we look at our culture and our politics, I often think to myself, as I look at our local and state politics, as well as our national politics, and I see what's happening in the culture around this idea that if you're not for me, you're against me.
And I
don't know where, and I keep thinking, oh, well, the church is better than that. The church, we're believers in Jesus Christ. We model our lives after the gospel message. And I keep thinking, and maybe naively so, that the church is going to be different from that. And yet, I come to the understanding that the church is a microcosm of the community in which it lives. So why would the church be any different? Why would the church be different than the community and culture in which it is? So thus, I think a big part of that has to do with the culture of our nation, the culture of our local communities and states, and annual conferences that have become less decentralized and more individualistic, less connectional and more communal, losing the sight of the gift of the connection as well. I'm a firm believer, at least here in Louisiana, and I think as I understand what's happening across our denomination, many of the churches who have left, in my opinion, I know what they voted on here in Louisiana, because I am currently on the Conference Board of Trustees, now not as a cabinet liaison, but as a member of the Conference Board of Trustees. I know in Louisiana, we required a certain language on the ballots of those churches who voted for 2553 that said, I am in opposition to the LGBTQIA plus individuals and congregations. That we made sure that they understood what they were voting on. But I would dare say most of our congregations, by far most of our congregations, voted on a sense of wanting power and prestige and control over their property, over the appointment of their pastor, over their finances. And though it was couched in the idea of voting on 2553 and the LGBTQIA journey that we find ourselves in, I would dare say most of them did not vote on that.
The swing has clearly been in the last 50 years towards a more individualistic approach and less communitarian approach. And that's been nationwide, particularly in the political scheme. One excellent book I read is and I can't think of the precise title. The author is Richard Haass, who was the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has served on both Democrat and Republican administrations in the White House. But he has this book out on a Bill of Obligations. And his point is that we approach the Bill of Rights, and it's very individualistically oriented. And his comment is that we need to place those in context, the fact that those we see those as individual issues, but they are also individual issues within a communitarian context. And that's the way his book has tried to focus. I am with you of the fact that sadly, the church here on this particular issue is too much like the population writ large. The original growth of the original Pauline Jesus-centered church in the first and second century was the fact that that body of people was so different than the world that they lived in. They rejected the world they lived in, which was part of the message of the early first, second, third century ecclesia, the early church. But we've gotten to a place now where we sadly, on a lot of issues, sort of conform to society at large.
Yeah, I just finished last evening a pastor's Bible study. It was our summer study where we looked at Galatians, Ephesians, and Philippians.
Yeah.
And at least with Galatians and Ephesians, you know, Paul's early conversations to those churches after founding them in his missionary journeys and writing back to them was about the disgruntledness within them, and they're fighting with each other about, you know, Jews and Gentiles and those sorts of things, and who was in and who was out. And amazingly, as we were studying that, you know, many in the Bible study, we're about 30 of us all together in the two sessions we do, 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. on Wednesdays. But many of them said, we haven't changed much.
No.
We haven't grown much. We haven't evolved much. The early fighting of the early Christians, and we're still fighting about who's in and who's out.
I've taught 1 Corinthians maybe 10 times in the last 25 years. And every time I teach 1 Corinthians, I feel like Paul could have written it this morning. So, yeah, it's there's elements of it which are very much in the now. I don't want to take you a lot more of your time. Is there anything that we covered that you'd like to come back over and put a point of amplification on or a little point of correction on before I say thank you and let you go?
Just that, you know, my hope and my prayer is that we find a way to focus on the main thing, and that that which we divide. I mean, we talked about this last night again in the Philippians study, is maybe in our humanistic nature, we concentrate on that which divides us.
Yeah.
And there are far less things that divide us than unite us.
Yeah.
And yet, we spend so much time and energy on the division piece. I'm blessed to be back in the local church, blessed to be living into my calling again as a pastor in a local church. I love being a pastor in a local church most days. Obviously, there are days of struggle, like anything, but I love being a pastor in a local church. And one of the things that, and when I came to this particular congregation a year ago, knowing that this was looming before us as a congregation, but also as a denomination, you know, there was rarely a day, and even today, you know, these days, there's rarely a day when the conversation of disaffiliation doesn't come up, where there's not someone who expresses concern or outrage or, you know, one way or the other. But one of the things I have said to my pastor colleagues here, who I serve with, as well as my staff, is I refuse to let that be the main focus of our ministry. We have important ministry to do to make disciples for Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world, to help people to know, grow, and go is our focus here at In God's Love here at Broadmoor. And Though I don't want to dismiss the concern of individuals related to disaffiliation and their concerns related to LGBTQIA plus individuals, I don't want it to be the primary focus of our ministry. And too often, I think we're letting it take the primary seat in our ministry and our preaching and our teaching and our leadership. And I think it devalues the gospel and the calling that God places in our lives. And again, I don't dismiss it as being unimportant, but I also don't want it to be the primary focus. And it will eat up all your time, energy that you will allow it, if you allow it.
I'm with you, Robert. I think that's the critical thing for us, is that how we take the nature of disaffiliation, and we use this moment in time as a threshold moment for us. How do we turn this for good? And I'd like to believe that we can turn it for good by now. Okay, this moment is past us. Let's now move on to what God is calling us as Broadmoor United Methodist Church, Shreveport, Louisiana, the Louisiana Conference, the Mountain Sky Conference, United Methodist Church. Let's move on that, and let's put this stage behind us. That's what I'm hoping we can do. Wybra, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, and blessings to you and Marilyn and your journey in life and faith. Thank you for your leadership, my friend.
Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye.